Hey, my name is Todd Campbell. I'm the director of photography on Homecoming and Mr. Robot, and you're listening to the Go Creative Show.
Hey, everyone. My name is Ben Consoli. I am a director and owner of BC Media Productions. And this is the Go Creative Show, this show dedicated to creative professionals in the video production and filmmaking industries. Today, I talk with cinematographer Todd Campbell. He's the director of photography for Homecoming and Mr. Robot. We're going to discuss his unique and progressive approach to cinematography and all the innovative techniques he used on both shows. The Go Creative Show is supported by Rule Boston Camera. Buy, rent, create at rule.com. Hedge.video, the fastest way to backup media. Shutterstock.com, Magnanimous Rentals, and PremiumBeat.com. Premium, royalty-free music and sound. I am so excited about this episode because, first of all, I am a giant fan of Homecoming. That was probably my favorite show of last year. Like, I was obsessed with that show. So if any of you guys love that show and you watch the show, this episode is going to really break down how they shot that show. And if you haven't seen it, you got to see the show. But this episode is still enjoyable regardless. And of course, Mr. Robot. I mean, who doesn't love that show? So we talk all about that as well. This is a jam-packed episode. Todd is great on the air, and he really gives us a lot of insight into how he creates the unique shots that he has, the unique look that he has. So there's so much in there. You guys are going to love it. But a couple little pieces of housekeeping first. We are really now starting to put a lot of effort into our Instagram page. So there's going to be on our Instagram, and this is all rolling out over the next couple of weeks, but we're going to be doing like short clips from the show. So little like 1 minute segments of important topics. They'll all be strewn about all over our Instagram. Of course, our Instagram stories is where you can go and actually respond to, but ask questions to our guests. So whenever I have a guest coming on, I post in the story and you guys have an opportunity to ask that guest questions. And we've been doing that the past couple episodes, and it's actually worked out really, really well. So go to Instagram, search Go Creative Show, and follow the page. It's still new, so we're still building right now, but more is to come. And that page is going to have a lot of focus put on it in the upcoming weeks, as well as our brand new website. So if you go to gocreativeshow.com, you can see a whole new website there. We are really gearing up for the second part of 2019 and really, pushing forward. We have a lot of momentum right now, thanks to all of you guys. And we're using that momentum and taking the show to the next level. So we really appreciate your support. So head over there, gocreativeshow.com. And of course, our new Instagram page at Go Creative Show. Now, before we get to the interview, I just want to take a moment and talk about Shutterstock.com. Now, Shutterstock, obviously, you can get images and photos and music and all sorts of stuff there. But one of the things that I use Shutterstock for a lot is my director's treatments. So think about this. If I'm bidding on a project, I need to stand out among the crowd. And my director's treatment needs to be a reflection of what my vision is. So I've been going to Shutterstock.com and finding images and finding video clips that really illustrate what I'm trying to do. And you're always going to find something gorgeous because Shutterstock is loaded with millions and millions of really beautiful images and clips. But it really has changed the game for me. My director's treatments are better. They're higher quality. I'm proud to present these to my clients. And judging by the way that the clients have been responding, they are working. So I strongly suggest you guys up your director's treatment game and head over to Shutterstock.com. I imagine too, as cinematographers, for those of you guys out there, it's also a great resource to get to illustrate the kind of look that you're going for. I mean, for that matter, wardrobe stylists, really anybody that has to illustrate what their vision is, you can do it through images and videos from Shutterstock.com. So head over there, check them out, and up your director's treatment game, people. It's going to make a difference. It's going to make a difference. Okay. So much to get to with Todd Campbell. I can't wait. I'm chomping at the bit. We're going to talk about Mr. Robot. We're going to talk about Homecoming, and it's coming up right now. So I'm here with Todd Campbell, the director of photography for Mr. Robot and Homecoming and a whole bunch more. We're going to get into all of it right here on Go Creative Show. Todd, thank you so much for being on.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
So first of all, I'm so happy that you are a listener of the show. It's like, it's the coolest thing to talk to people that already like the show. It's, I don't know, sometimes you do the show and you think, no one's listening. It's weird because you're sitting in here. It's just two people talking. You don't realize that other people are paying attention sometimes.
I think it's pretty far reaching. Honestly, I've talked to a lot of other DPs, my friend Pepe, a lot of guys I met at Camera Image, and we've discussed you at length, my friend.
Oh my God. I hope it's all good things.
It is indeed.
Well, I mean, I am such a fan of the work that you did on Homecoming. I mean, Mr. Robot's awesome. It's been around for 4 seasons. It's great. The visuals are stunning. Homecoming, I think what it was for me with Homecoming is that I wasn't expecting anything. I didn't know you were involved. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know it came from a podcast. It honestly was like, hey, Julia Roberts is in some show. Like, we haven't heard her name in a while. What's going on? Like that was kind of how Homecoming became, ended up on my TV. And wow, what a stunning, stunning show. My God, you do amazing work.
So thank you very much. It's clearly a labor of many people. I feel like we finally got together. I think Mr. Robot is great, of course, and it's amazing. And it was our first time for Sam and I to get together and tell this story. But I was really excited to get into something new with Sam and take everything that we had learned and our process and style and apply it to something else and to see how we would fare. And I'm just pretty tickled the fact that it came out as we had hoped. And I think it's more polished and different, but kind of the same. So it was nice to apply all those techniques that we learned and just better them on something different, that still has a little bit of the same vibe, this sort of conspiracy thriller. There's definitely some things in Homecoming that are not too far from Mr. Robot. So yeah, I think it was a really great choice, for Sam to take this on and to allow me to come along as well. And shoot it.
And the Sam we're talking about is Sam. How am I pronouncing his last name?
Esmail.
Esmail. And the creator of the show. TV works different than movies. I mean, sometimes you can have the creator, the visionary, the person that's really like making the show what it is, and then have multiple directors along the way. It's different than the way it is with movies, as I'm sure the audience here knows. Sam and you together sort of created the look of both of these things and the feel and the vibe of them. You guys have been working together for a long time. Kind of, how did that collaboration start? And, who brought these sort of really dramatic cinematography images to the forefront? I mean, because you guys have, there's a strong vision on both shows.
Well, I think that, I'll try to quickly breeze through this. I was a camera operator for a long time, and a friend of mine, John Leonetti, had a TV show in North Carolina, and he was leaving to go direct a movie, and he needed somebody to take his place, and he called me. I'd operated for him in the past and shot a lot of second unit stuff, and he's like, hey, if we can get you in here to shoot the second unit, when I tell them I'm leaving, it would be an easy shoo-in for you to bump up to director of photography. And all that worked. So I was shooting Sleepy Hollow, season 2.
As a and, second unit, Sleepy Hollow?
No, at that point I'd bumped up. In the middle of season 1, I'd bumped up to the DP.
Is that a common trajectory? Like, do people in second unit oftentimes bump up? Is that kind of the way in?
I don't know if there's a perfect algorithm, but I would say, I've seen it happen a few times. I worked as an operator and then an A operator, and, would shoot the second units, which were largely, a hand grabbing a phone. It worked out for me, and I've seen it work for a few other people. I don't know it's the best one, but it is a one. And I think, the timing for me, was good because television was really starting to, open up at that point, I don't know. I feel like I got really lucky, but I was on that show. An old producer friend of mine, who I had met on Friday Night Lights, she had this small series at USA called Mr. Robot. And she connected me with Sam, and we had an interview. And, luckily I got the job and we started there. So when I came on to Mr. Robot, Sam was directing what is the second episode, because they had already done the pilot. And, we started there, and that particular season of Mr. Robot had multiple directors, and I was the only DP So it was really difficult. And I think Sam directed episode 2, episode 7, episode 10 of that season. Mm-hmm. And then we went into season 3. I think he was more happy just to direct them all.
Yeah.
And so it kind of turned into a little bit of a movie vibe there. But that's where we started. And the way, you know, in terms of, to answer the question, bringing those visuals, I think, you know, we both push each other. You know, I think that, you know, Sam has a very strong visual idea of what he wants. And, you know, trying to get into his head was, I don't even know if I'm there yet. I think we push each other and, you know, from a lighting and camera perspective, you know, I don't know. I just try to listen and figure out what he wants. He's very specific about certain things, very specific about certain things. And then some of the other details and variables, you know, I'll try to bring to the table and match to what he's, where I think he's wanting to go. And I don't know, so far it's worked well. That was the greatest thing about Homecoming. You know, we all feel very comfortable with Robot and how we do things there. And, you know, I was excited to start a different story. And I think we did better than we'd done in the past. So, yeah, I mean, right now it's working well. And there's a shorthand there. And, you know, there's a comfort level. And, you know, I find it difficult even when I go on to other projects with other directors. You know, I have to kind of take a step back and think it through a little more rather than just, you know, run right out there, set up the camera and light it and say ready, which is what I can kind of do with Sam. You know, there's a little more discussion that has to be had when I'm working with other people, but, I don't know. I really enjoy working with Sam. I'm pretty happy. Hopefully that continues forever and, we can just go make great stuff together. I think we do all right.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, do you like having somebody, well, you said at times Sam is very specific. He knows exactly what he wants. He's very detail-oriented with that. Do you like those moments, or do you kind of like more being able to establish things on your own? Not that you're not, but you know what I mean. Like, do you like every once in a while having somebody come in and say, I love what you're doing, but here is exactly what I'm looking for?
I do like it. You know, in the very beginning when I was, you know, and I'm still a young DP, even though I'm not young, I was resistant to it in the beginning and really, you know, kind of challenged him more often of what I thought was the right idea, wanting to, you know, kind of control more. But, you know, then after you spend enough time with someone and get to know them, and then, you know, most importantly, really trust them, you know, like even when I may not think it's the right idea, or I think the composition could be a little better like this, you know, he's my director and I completely trust him. I mean, everything he touches, I align with almost perfectly. So, you know, I don't feel so bad, you know, anymore. Like he's got his ideas and I believe in him. And, you know, more often than not, you know, once it comes out and I see it cut together and edited, I'm like, he was right. I don't have that anymore, really.
That's kind of interesting. You said, you know, earlier on, you may have been a little bit more pushy. I don't think that's the right word, but you may have been a little bit more, you know, standing your ground when it comes to your visuals. Do you think that that's the right approach? Like, I mean, obviously it worked for you, but I'm thinking to myself, like, I think some people may be on set and they'll think, you know, my job is to create, you know, visually create what the director wants. And other people may think, no, my job is to create the visuals. Like, there's a distinction there.
Well, I think, you know, for me, I don't know if it's for this way for everyone. I mean, clearly we're going to start with the story and what's the best thing for the story, obviously.
Sure.
You know, I take it, you know, Sean Levy is a director I worked with on Stranger Things for the episodes I did there and got along with him. Well, he was much more hands-off. You know, and I did find it somewhat liberating that way. But at the same time, there's also, you're juggling so many things. And, you know, having Sam, you know, take some of those variables out of my, you know, equation, I find I can spend a little more time on the lighting or a little, you know, I can now, you know, maybe let Sam work with the operator, you know, a little more than I might on other jobs. So I like it actually. And I think, you know, the more information that I can have from a director, the better. Cause I think we could just ultimately, you know, I can make him happier and I allow him to tell his story, you know, and supplement that, you know, with what I do. So I personally like it, but I have friends, other DP friends who, you know, have, you know, really want to put a stranglehold on the visuals. And that may be right for some other directors. In my world with Sam, I don't mind sharing, you know, that. I mean, if he is such a visual person that, I don't know, it works well in this scenario, and I'm pretty happy with it. But yeah, I can totally understand the other side of it. I did a pilot earlier this year, and it was the opposite. So I don't know. I like both, you know. It was freeing to go do that for a little bit, but it's also, I mean, Sam's, everything we do is so unbelievably technical. it's nice to have a little bit of weight lifted off your shoulders, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that everything is so technical. It feels, I think the common thread between what you do with Mr. Robot and I keep wanting to say Homeland every time, Homecoming, is that it's really like a study in tension almost. Like every shot is tense. There's very few moments where you can relax. Like it's an exhausting experience, especially Homecoming. I think it's short, it's fast. There's so much in it. It's really, really tense feeling all the time. And I mean, I love that. I think that's what gives it its unique perspective. Do you feel like you're creating tension in your cinematography?
Yeah, I mean that's the idea. You know, I think the one thing in Homecoming that really ramps that up is the music.
Oh yeah.
I think that really, you know, that we were shooting, I don't know, it may have been the third or fourth day of photography, and we were shooting all the guys coming into the main area where they eat the food. And there was no dialogue in this shot. It was just a series of push-ins, you know, getting them into the cafeteria. And we were kind of timing out this big, long push-in that then turned into a Zoom that then turned into the pineapple. And Sam pulled up the music. I think it's the song that's actually in the show. I think it's from Marathon Man. And once he played the music, on his phone aloud for our Dolly Grip Mango to hear it, and for all of the technicians to kind of, you know, find a zone to be in, you know, creatively, that kind of set the tone for us. So, you know, the music, which creates the tension, I think was also kind of driving, you know, some of the cadence in which we were shooting and the timing of the shots, you know. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, the tension, you know, supplied with the music. But yeah, when we're shooting, you know, the idea of like, you know, how you're lensing it, how tight you want to be, are we pushing in, are we pulling away, you know, all those things are a factor. And yeah, I mean, you know, Sam and I shot list every single scene of the entire show prior to shooting. So there's much, when we're actually doing it, you know, we were in a office somewhere where we could, you know, not be bothered by other people and really think about how to photograph this story. And rather than trying to figure that out on the day, I think, you know, that's where the success comes from, is like really being able to plot out perfectly, you know, a plan and then just execute on the day. I mean, clearly there's going to be times where you have to change or whatever, but largely, you know, is to figure out how to make this show the best, create this tension. Where do we want to be in what moment? Whose point of view are we in at this moment? And all that's done prior to us shooting so that we can, you know, be fully focused on that only in that moment.
I want to talk about the prep for Homecoming, because I really didn't know this until well into the series when I was watching it, that it came from a podcast. I had no idea of the same
Eli
name.
And Micah. Mm-hmm.
Of the same name, Homecoming. Were you familiar with the podcast before you got involved in this project? And you know, how much did you get inspired by that podcast for it?
Well, when we were shooting season 3 of Mr. Robot, and he had mentioned, you know, wanting to do this, that he was talking to Eli and Micah about Homecoming, the podcast. And, you know, so he's like, you should give it a listen. And I was pretty floored. I think the thing that I loved the most about it was the format, you know, these quick little 22 minute episodes where, you know, I think that's what makes Homecoming so tight, is being, you know, its format. It's 30 minute episodes. You know, you can just really densely pack the story into 30 minutes rather than being an hour long, where I think sometimes, you know, things can, you know, they tend to get a little boring. You know, the challenge, the Homecoming pilot, I listened to it, I loved it. I thought the actors were great. I thought everything about it was great.
Yeah.
I was a little nervous about taking a podcast, you know, where, you know, you can picture everything in your mind when you're listening to it. And now we're going to take this audio file and turn it into a bunch of visuals.
Why were you nervous?
In my mind, there was a lot of, you know, Walter and Heidi sitting in an office and talking. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, how are we going to keep that interesting? You know, so that was my fear. I was like, is it going to become two talking heads in an office? It's like In Treatment in my mind, like that show on HBO. And I was like, we should, you know, so we got into it. And once they started writing the scripts, which, you know, changed a little bit, they added a few things here and there. Then I felt they came up with a really good balance of being in the office with Walter and Heidi, which I think is obviously clearly the most important for that relationship. And then also, you know, the rest of the characters maybe were bolstered a little bit. So it wasn't just solely in an office, but I was a little nervous about that. But you know, we approached that as, you know, when we're in Heidi's office, we tend to be, when they're talking, you know, we don't move the camera a lot. We wanted to be very static and kind of create a place for them to act and where you would not focus on a camera movement or anything else and just watch them and, you know, really pay attention to what they're saying, you know. And then when we're outside of her office, you know, we felt like really, you know, kind of embodying those, you know, 1970s conspiracy thrillers, I guess, with zooms and a moving camera to create more, you know, of a frenetic feel and vibe that also works with attention. When you have those two together, you know, you're very stilted and solid, you know, and then you're constantly moving. We felt like that would be a good way to, you know, juxtapose that and give it a little sense of dread, I guess.
So you're familiar with the podcast. You're a little nervous because you're thinking, how are we going to make this interesting? Because you didn't want it to be another In Treatment, and you wanted it to, you know, reflect the show that it existed, but to have some visual element to it. So where did you go to get your visual inspiration? Because there was no visual inspiration for this. I mean, it was just an audio format. I'd love to know kind of where you went. What inspired you to create the look that it has?
Well, you know, in terms of, we really want, I guess it comes from really examining Heidi's character. I guess that's probably, you know, where I would have maybe not have said, okay, I'm going to start with Heidi's character. Just that's where your brain would go when you start a job, I think.
Okay.
So looking at it from her perspective and, you know, the two different timelines, that was probably the most exciting thing about, you know, listening to the podcast is that there's two different timelines, you know.
Yeah, clearly. So for the people that aren't familiar with it, it takes place in 2018 and then also 2020, but something, I'm sorry, 2022. But there's something interesting about it because you never really quite know, especially in the first episode, nothing really feels like it's a time period. You don't really know where you are. You don't know when you are. Nothing really makes sense. I think part of the tension we were talking about earlier is that it's unsettling. You can't totally connect to anything. Everything feels a little distant and confusing. And that's just like a common thread throughout the whole thing. So sorry to interrupt, but we were talking about visual inspiration for this.
Yeah. So, you know, approaching it from Heidi's perspective, that's, you know, the thing. I don't know. We can do spoilers or not. People haven't seen the show now.
Of course, the show's been out for a while, and yeah. Oh, spoil it. Who cares? People know what to expect.
So, you know, with in 2022, she doesn't, you know, she's kind of has like an amnesia. And in 2018, she's got this new job and she's very excited and enthusiastic. So that's kind of where it came from for me. I knew that it was set in Florida, you know, so that to me says, you know, sunny, puffy clouds and sunny days. In my world of thinking, you know, I thought, you know, for the 2018 stuff, we should be very bright and beautiful with still some lingering, something underlying underneath it, that just like under the facade, something's off. That was the sort of my first note to myself for 2018. For 2022, you know, I didn't exactly know where it should go or what should do. You know, Sam and I don't like to do, you know, black and white for a, you know, a flashback, you know. Yeah. And I also was really excited that the time change was only 4 years apart. So nothing, you know, cars aren't really different. You know, there's really nothing that different. Maybe there's a new iPhone or two. So that was you know, also challenging, but kind of exciting. Cause I was like, God, you'll really be able to kind of, you know, mess with people. They won't quite know. So, you know, but we did need to delineate the two time periods. And that kind of gets into this whole aspect ratio thing that we got into, which is probably my favorite aspect of the show, from a cinematographer standpoint. But that, you know, because she, you know, doesn't remember anything or why or how or any of that, you know, so she's, we wanted to kind of, you know, relay that visually, without going too heavy handed, although we ended up choosing the aspect ratio change. So we go to a 1:1 aspect ratio in 2022 with her. And then of course, 16:9 in 2018, you know, I didn't really change. I played all the lighting and kind of camera work and all that stuff. I wanted to be really subtle with, and let the aspect ratio do the heavy lifting, to tell that story. And so that's, you know, when I think back to the early days of listening to the podcast, reading the first scripts, you know, I'd been shooting such dark Mr. Robot stuff. I was kind of excited to do something that you could actually see for once. so that was kind of where I was born. So I wanted like really hard sun and specular highlights and, you know, just this kind of, this enthusiasm that she has for life. I wanted to feel that in the lighting. In 2018 and 2022, we would go to the box. You know, we didn't want to, you know, I didn't want any hard light in any of the sets. I didn't want any specular highlights. I wanted things to be a little more muted, but not too much that it, you know, it's so heavy handed that, you know, cause I feel like the aspect ratio was going to the work, but I wanted to have some subtleties in there photographically, that could help, you know, things are just a little more dull, you know, that's kind of the vibe of the lighting anyway that I was going for in 2022. So the when, you know, the references, I didn't really have any, you know, like it was just more about, kind of putting myself in her shoes and what life would look like, that way. And kind of going from there, Sam, you know, had tonally, you know, that's how it looks in my mind. And then Sam kind of, when we got together, you know, he uses a lot. He loves references. That's a big thing for me. He's seen every movie ever made. He's a cinephile for sure. Yeah. But he really started talking about these kind of 70s thrillers because obviously the material lends itself that way. So he really wanted to start incorporating zooms, like The Conversation and movies like that. So that's tonally where we kind of arrived, and kind of just, you know, put all that in a blender. And then, you know, spit it out. And I don't know. That's kind of, that was my path on Homecoming. It was a little all over the place, but, ultimately, well, you know, just trying to take that, you know, a point of view from her. That's always like our first conversation.
I think what's interesting about the 1:1 aspect ratio is that, first of all, it feels, when you first see it, it feels like it's a flashback. I don't think the assumption is that it's a flash forward because it's grainier, it's darker, it's grittier. And plus the production design in those scenes, it just where she works in the home she's living in, it just all feels old. So you're a little bit confused when you start learning that it's actually a flash forward, but it makes total sense because she doesn't see the whole picture. She doesn't remember everything. So of course the screen isn't fully there, you know, it's like neither is her memory. So, and I love that choice. I thought that was really, really, really cool. And that's the thing that everybody talked about. I mean, it's so hard to stand out in TVs or TV shows because there's so many amazing ones. And for people to be like, oh, you got to see Homecoming. Just there's something about that 1:1 aspect ratio is unexpected and it worked. And it's also familiar. So people kind of had, people had a memory of what that felt like watching TV in that aspect ratio. And it really was striking.
Yeah. Thank you. It was when we, you know, we talked about, you know, being 2:4:0 going to 16:9 and all these different ratios coming up, like, you know, just making up two new aspect ratios was, you know, we were on that for a minute. You know, and then Sam ultimately, you know, I was really pushing for 2:4:0 just because, you know, I shot anamorphic lenses. I didn't want to crop into the 16:9, but he was right. You know, when you look at it, you know, so many people watch on their iPads and phones and televisions and all this stuff. So, you know, making it 16:9 was totally the right call. And then just cutting that in half you know, so that you would just pillar box on the left and right side of the frame when you go to the 2022 world. It worked out to be the best. And I think, you know, yeah, once we committed to it and made the choice, you know, I was like, God, this is so the right idea, especially the way people view their content these days. But yeah, it's my favorite part of the whole thing. I was so excited, and doing it, I was so terrified, not terrified because they don't really mess with sand, but I was like, I would stack, you know, all the C stands and flags and shit right up to the edges of the 1x1 frame. So if they ever tried to
pop out, that's risky,
you know, cause I was like, I don't want them ruining it, you know, and that could easily happen. I think, I don't know. But just to safeguard our visuals, I just put stuff, they'd have to just VFX the hell out of the edges of it to get it back to 16x9. So yeah.
Oh, I see. Sorry, I was misinterpreting that. So you purposefully put stuff in the borders so that there was no chance that they were going to open that framing up.
That's right.
Wow, that's sneaky.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it was, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, probably so. Sam would never let that happen, but I was just like, I don't know. I'm definitely not going to protect for 16x9 when it shouldn't be. So we'll just make sure that.
I love that. Well, I got the deal of a lifetime. Listen to this. I needed an Alexa Mini. So I went to magrents.com. That's for Magnanimous Rentals. Now, these guys are a production equipment rental house based in Chicago, but they ship all over the country. So I went to magrents.com, and there was a flash discount on an Alexa Mini, and I got it for half price. Half price. Now, Alexa Minis are not cheap cameras, so 50% off is a big deal. Now, let me take a step back. What is a flash discount, you ask? Here's the thing. Magnanimous Rentals has a great inventory, okay? You can rent your equipment and ship it anywhere in the country. Orders over $500 are shipped for free. So those are the things you need to know. But the best thing about Magnanimous Rentals is that their prices cannot be beat. They just can't be beat. First of all, their regular price is already excellent. Then they have dynamic prices in blue that are auto-lowered below the regular price, but they change each day, and they make sure that you get the best price available in the world, okay? They also have flash discounts, which are huge, significant, very, very significant discounts. In my case, it was a 50% discount off the Alexa Mini, but it's only a limited time. So when you go to their site and you see a bright red flashing price, that's a flash discount, and you have a limited time to take advantage of that rental. So that's what I suggest you guys do. Head over to magrents.com, and maybe you can get an outrageous deal on an Alexa Mini or whatever else you want, whatever else is available at flash discount. But you have to check every day because it changes all the time. Magrents.com. And lastly, let's talk about Hedge. Hedge is the backup software for filmmakers. It's super fast. You can import multiple sources, send it to multiple destinations all at the same time. So it's perfect for all of us production people because you're always backing up media, let's be honest. Now, here's the thing. They just announced a Frame.io integration. This is huge. So if you have Frame.io, Hedge will automatically detect if you have it and if you have watch folders set up. Now, if you have a watch folder set up, that folder is it's automatically loaded into the destination area of the app. So when you open the app, you've got sources on the left, destinations on the right. Now, this is cool because imagine you're on set, you're backing up your media. You can send your media to your hard drive, certainly, but you can also send it to your watch folder at the same time, which is awesome because then you're backing up your media and maybe your editor is ready to start working right away. So think of the time savings. Think of the convenience. And of course, it's Hedge and it's Frame.io, so you know it's going to have really seamless integration. Now, this is an excellent app. It's an excellent integration. I love this new pairing between the two companies, and you guys will love it too. So head over to hedge.video and type in Go Creative Show at checkout. You get 20% off the full license. But there's so much there to explore and to learn. And if you're not familiar with Hedge, you've got to go there and learn about it. Because anybody listening to Go Creative Show, we are production people. We can use Hedge. We can get the benefits of Hedge. This app is for us. So head over to hedge.video/GoCreativeShow and check it out for yourself. I want to talk about shooting overhead. The opening scene is something that we certainly have to dive into. It seemed incredibly complicated. It's a oneer. It's beautiful. It opens up with a shot of a fish tank. So immediately, the first second you watch the show, you're like, what am I watching? But you can't stop. And it immediately starts revealing this overhead look, which carries through quite a bit throughout the season. And I absolutely love it. I want to get some thoughts from you as to, you know, when did you guys start deciding that overhead was the way to go for that opening shot, or portions of it, I should say? And what does that actually do cinematically?
Well, you know, I think the overarching idea of the overhead shot, you know, which is predominantly in the facility, is kind of, you know, to put these guys under a microscope, I guess would probably be the best way to describe it. Hmm. You know, we wanted to look down on them. We wanted to get a sense that somebody's peering in on them, you know. So that's where, you know, her desk, there's a lot of things that happen on that desk, you know, throughout, you know, he turns the pin, you know, he turns the fork at the end. Like, we wanted to set up and establish these things. So that was kind of the point of that, but the overall idea was to look top down, you know, in this facility at these guys. And that's where that was the original. And also, I mean, it gives you a sense of geography, I think, especially when you're high and wide, and, you know, and it just kind of became a theme for us, you know, especially traveling, you know, I mean, probably my favorite shot in the whole show is in episode 3, where Carrasco, Shea Whigham,
the opening
is descending
shot
down the stairs. Yeah, he's going down those stairs, and we're, you know, on a descender rig pushing down these stairs. It looks like something out of a Kubrick movie.
Yes. The staircase shot.
Oh my God. I couldn't believe we walked into this location. Literally was going downstairs and walked in the staircase, and I was like, oh my God. I was like, Sam, you've got to see this. And yeah, we're like, well, this is the stairs Carrasco will go down. It's not even remotely anywhere close to the rest of the stuff we shot with him. It was just such a cool staircase. And it went on forever. I was like, oh, that's great. Yeah, that's probably, but so it did thematically, you know, really the top downs really started to work. And we all felt like they have this feeling to them that, that just felt right for this kind of this thematic, tonally what we were going for. It really just worked.
You had said earlier that you basically storyboarded everything before you shot. So you knew exactly what you were going to do leading into that. So that decision, was made way before. This wasn't something that you sort of tested on set and said, oh, that looks good, let's go with it. Knowing that Sam is, yeah. Go ahead.
No, you're right. We didn't have, and like, we didn't storyboard. We would just shot list, like, you know, here's what we want to do. Okay. Some of those, like that stairs, you know, I don't remember what we had written down prior, but when we, you know, saw that, it was like, oh God, this has to be, you know, Carrasco descending down into the bowels of, you know, this place. So, I guess that's where I'm saying is, like, some things it changes, you know, you find a location, you know, we tried not to shot list before finding a location, and kind of sometimes that will infer, you know, like where you want to be, or maybe how, you know, the blocking can lay out, you know, for specific windows or time of day or whatever. So that's where it can change a little bit, but that's, you know, we still try to adjust when you walk across something that's that amazing as that stairwell.
Oh my God, how can you not? So how much of this was on set versus like a studio that you created? Was the entire homecoming facility like an actual?
Yeah, that was a build. That was like a 22,000 square foot build. Our production designer, Stasha, who's been with us since the beginning, that she put together, which was amazing. It was huge. It was awesome. But I would say 60% of that show probably was on stage. Mm. Clearly all that stuff, but you know, like the Carrasco bits, and the only thing that we built for him was, you know, those rows of boxes of all those files that he's down there trying to dig up and understand, unravel this puzzle.
That, by the way, is my favorite shot. The shot right after the staircase shot, which I love the staircase shot, but the next shot when he's walking down, it's not like a totally top, it's not a completely overhead shot, sort of on an angle, but when the lights follow him down that hallway, I mean,
dude,
it's amazing.
I read that script and was like, and immediately I was like, oh, fuck. I was like, Sam, just can we build this? You know, I know it's a pain in the ass. We have to make all these rows of boxes and there'll be VFX out the wazoo, you know, because you could clearly find that. But I was like, I had the idea for, like, because I'd walked in a warehouse, you know, I don't know, a year or so ago prior, and those lights followed me. I was like, God, that's what a genius idea. And so when we had this, I was like, dude, we will have this light that just follows his all the way down and all the way down the row. I was like, God, it's like too good to pass up. This is perfect.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm glad you mentioned that shot, because that's probably my second favorite shot. And I was so excited that we were able to pull it off.
Of all the shots from that entire series, that one really sticks in my head. Like when I think of Homecoming, I think of that shot. It's weird. I don't know why. It just sort of got me. The way that just the lights following him, he was so small in the frame. It was super wide.
Dude,
it was just awesome. It was great.
Yeah, we really wanted to make him feel like this tiny little guy in this massive, you know, it's just everything's above, you know, he's just this little fella, you know, in this like towering world of information that he has to sift through. Yeah, I was really, really pleased with that whole sequence.
So I'm sorry, we were talking about, you built the sets, about 60% of it was built. I want to talk about the, there's like so much I want to talk about because I'm such a fanboy with the series. Now we're on the topic of sort of overhead and following shots. So let's just stay there, because in the first episode, also the way that you reveal the Homecoming space is extraordinarily unique. And I'm a sucker for a great reveal, and you certainly did an amazing reveal on that. The opening shot, you go through her office, but then after she leaves the office, you're now going through the entire building. We're starting as a viewer to understand where we are, get a sense, you know, get a lay of the land, but you're not even following the main character for most of it. But you hear her on the phone. It was a very strong choice. I loved it and would like to know where that came from.
Well, that was the very, very first conversation Sam and I ever had. We were literally shooting Mr. Robot. And once we had decided, he decided that he was going to do this and we were all going to go make this show. The very first thing he said, he's like, we were talking about the podcast and I just listened to it. And he said, I really want that, I want a oneer, you know, that tracks overhead and through this whole facility with Heidi as she's describing to Colin, you know, what the facility looks like, and we're meeting some of the guys and all this stuff. And so that, man, and I have to tell you, we discussed and we had about a billion meetings about that particular shot, you know, back in December. I mean, before we even had the stages. I'm sorry, there's somebody knocking on my door. Give me just one second.
Yeah, go ahead.
My girlfriend. That was like,
is she in the industry?
No, she makes hats.
What?
She's cute. Yeah, she makes hats.
What's the name of the company? Let's plug it.
Fallen Feather. FallenFeather. Fallen Feather.
Fallen Feather hats. It's so weird. Is it just women's hats, or do they do men's hats too?
No, men and women.
It's so weird that you said that, because like literally all year long, I know, and all of my friends, whoever's listening to this that are just friends of mine, they're going to be very annoyed by this, because I've been talking about wanting to start wearing hats all year. I don't know what it is. For some reason, I went to Curacao. Everybody's wearing kind of the Panama hat thing. I'm like, I'm obsessed with hats this year. But I'm like nervous because I don't think I have, I just don't think I'm cool enough to wear a hat.
Dude, I've been the same way. Listen, like I met her and like, I don't wear hats. Not like the ones she makes, you know, like the Panama. And she's made me 3 or 4 of them. I'm wearing them all the time. It just took me like a couple of weeks of looking at myself in the mirror with a hat on to finally kind of get okay with it. So yeah, you just got to put one on. I don't know. Everybody at work made fun of me for the first couple of days. They're like, what's with the new look, dude? Is this like your DP look? I'm like, I don't know, man. I'm just trying to, like, I want to wear a hat, you know? Anyway.
What's the name of it again? I want to search it as we're talking. I have to see these hats now. I'm obsessed now.
Fallen Feather.
Fallen Feather.
Fallen. F-A-L-L-E.
Oh, Fallen Feather. Okay. Okay.
Yes.
Fallen Feather. Oh, I'm looking at it right now. I don't know why. For some reason, I've just become obsessed with hats. It's very, very odd. But I guess, I don't know. I think I just have to try it. But that's the thing. I don't want to walk on set with a hat. Everyone's going to be like, what the hell are you doing?
No, I know. It definitely took a minute. But
all right, anyway. So there's a digression, but that's fine. I'm in a hat phase. So who knows? I might be purchasing some hats from her soon.
Yeah, well, we'll get her to make one up. She makes them custom fit to your head.
Oh, my God. All right, cool. All right. So we're talking about that. Sam, Sam has been thinking about this shot since even before you had the sets built.
Yeah. And so when we got to, when I went out to LA and the first thing I had to do when they were designing the set, because the entire roof, I mean, the set's so big. I mean, it is like really, 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 really big. And I had to kind of make some decisions on how much of the roof needs to pull off so that we can fly, you know, a 75-foot techno crane over this whole set and reach into all these specific points. It was really, technically, it was really, really difficult. It took a lot of people to pull that off. But yeah, the idea behind it was just to discover this place while she's talking about it. And you know, there's some stitches in there. You know, it was impossible to do that shot without stitching.
Yeah.
So I think there was two or three stitches. But even, you know, that was all the set up until when she walks out and, you know, down there where the reception office is, that's a actual location. So we had to, you know, make a stitch there. But then, you know, that big crane shot that pulls her down the hallway, it was a dolly that then loads onto a crane that then backtracks like 70 feet while she's descending down the stairs and then pushes back into the door when she's leaving. It was a major undertaking. But that was, you know, for us kind of a, you know, that's Sam. That's so Sam. You know, he was like, I don't want to cut. I want to like experience this whole thing in one shot. And those are the right times to do it. I thought that shot really paid off well because of the phone call that, you know, you couldn't really cut around. And yeah, it really, I don't know. I'm a big fan of it too. I really like felt like that to pull it off. I mean, that was like 2 days of rehearsal. And then I think we got it on like take 5.
Wow.
You know, it was really, yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah, it really was incredible. And now, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm like 99% sure I'm right though. Didn't you guys have a scene that was overhead following a van that was kind of through?
Yeah, so that was done. We were trying to transition time there. So when the guys are leaving the facility, they're going to go out and have a beer, which they're not supposed to do.
That's right.
We wanted to transition because the next thing they do is they show up at this thing. So we're transitioning day to night there. And then I just didn't want to do it, you know, with the dialogue in the car and all that stuff. And so, you know, Sam, you know, it was his idea. He wanted to go over top of the van leaving, you know, to kind of get a sense of space, you know, and where they are. And then, so we shot that on a drone. And then, you know, we did day and we did night. And Chad, our VFX guy, you know, did a great job of stabilizing it. So that like the, you know, we could perfectly doing it with the drone, trying to make a perfect 90-degree turn.
Yeah.
With the van below you is, I'm just going to tell you right now, it's impossible. That is just not possible to make a perfect turn like that and keep speed of the van to the drone. We were able to get pretty close, but Chad was able to take it a little further and really make it, you know, lock the camera to the van. You know, some of the part of that being, a lot of our other driving shots, we used what's called a safari rig where we could take the camera, like the car, like there's a, it's an arm, like a, I forget whatever the material name, it's a real lightweight arm, but we can take the camera 22 feet away from the back of the vehicle and 12 feet high. Oh. And the camera's locked to the car. So a lot of those in the driving sequences where you see cars and there's a camera following the car, that was, and then they erased the arm from the shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was like, we wanted to, you know, and all of our, all the pieces of coverage of people in cars, you know, the camera is locked to the car. So that was, we didn't want to be handheld, you know, cause it's not very specific. So composition was important to us. And so we just, we wanted all cameras to be locked to all cars at all times. That's kind of how that was my methodology anyway, of how that all of our car work should be done. But yeah, that's, and so the overhead shot, same thing. We wanted the camera to be locked to that van as it's traveling. And so, yeah, that was,
what did you shoot on?
I shot on the DXL2. This is my first time to go with Panavision, my focus puller and, this guy named Serge Nofield. Awesome, awesome guy, kind of encouraged me. And the biggest factor of that was, meeting Dan Sasaki, who's the lens guru there, and he was able to take the G series anamorphics and kind of manipulate them in a way you know, for a little lower contrast. You know, he took the kind of the these are pretty center punched, and he was able to manipulate kind of the focus area and move it slightly for us because of, you know, you know, the way we were going to shoot this, and because we were going to be lopping off the edges of the actual anamorphic, which is where they're really great, in my opinion. He was able to kind of mess up the edges for us a little bit. He also was able to take the top and the bottom of frame. You can see it in there quite a bit. Like the bottom of frame is just obliterated. You know, like maybe the bottom 10% of the image just goes so utterly out of focus.
Yeah.
Even on the focus plane, you know, it'll just, and same thing at the top. And, you know, that was like that, you know, for the 2018 world, those subtleties that I was trying to get to where it looks perfect and clean and beautiful, Florida sun streaming through the window, but the edges are, there's just something a little off, and the top and bottom of frame I thought would be a good place to kind of help out a little bit with that. Just so you got a little sense of something's off. But yeah, so Panavision DXL2 with the G series anamorphics is what I went with. And, you know, they're, you know, what I knew was going to be not a problem. You know, we are like to play into symmetry quite a bit and keeping lines straight at times, or just going completely the other direction. You know, the anamorphic lenses, you know, you have to kind of get down with the bendiness of them. You know, you're not going to make up any perfectly straight lines, which I also felt like could work well to try to do that. But then there, you know, some of the lines just aren't quite straight. And we felt like that would be another subtle way of telling, you know, there's something a little off about this facility.
Yeah, I think the bending kind of works because it even makes it even just that little extra bit odd.
Exactly.
And yeah, I mean,
it does work.
I certainly noticed this small out of focus at the, you know, the borders of the lenses. I just thought that was something you did in post. I didn't think you were manipulating lenses to do it. And it's kind of interesting to see a choice like that made in camera because you can't get out of it.
Well, I feel like since I've been with Sam and he allows for like, you know, pretty bold choices and decisions like that, you know, and, you know, the more I can do in camera, the better for me anyway. And I think that, you know, I'm also able to appreciate it more when actually shooting it. Cause I'll, you know, I'm not going to go back and fuzz the bottom and tops later. I think that could get lost or might, you know, we run out of VFX money. We don't have time to go in there and do that. The more I can create in camera, the better. And then it does, and it locks you in. And that way, you know, your visuals and your storytelling techniques aren't going to, you know, be meddled with later on, you know, just the closer I can get on the day is the best thing for me. But that was a big part of choosing Panavision and having, you know, Dan be able to manipulate those lenses like that. That was a big deal for me. I'd never had that ability before. So that was a big deciding factor. And those guys were just cool and really took care of me and treated us like I'm a real director of photography. It was awesome.
You don't feel like that sometimes?
I don't know, man. I'm still so like new at this that, you know, yeah, I kind of feel like at some point somebody up there at Universal will be like, hang on, who is this guy? Like, is he supposed to be here or should we get like a real DP over here to like do some of this? I don't know. Yeah. I just kind of feel like I'm not, I don't know. Yeah. I still have that feeling. I don't know why.
Feel sometimes like you're faking it still. You haven't yet made it. You're still faking it until that moment, right?
I don't know, man. Sometimes. Yeah. Just happy to be where I'm at.
That's so weird. It's weird. It's interesting to hear that because I mean, it's just the visuals you're creating are so forward and like everyone's noticing and everybody loves it. It's weird that you feel that way. Maybe it's just because you haven't, I mean, you've been doing a long time. I mean, Mr. Robot's been out for you going into your fourth season now. And
yeah, it's been like 5 years. Yeah. I mean, no, I don't totally feel that way, but sometimes I mean, you know, I listen to your show, I listen to John Schwartzman, you know, and this, you know, the amount of knowledge and experience that he has and, you know, any of these guys, you know, all of them, Hoyta, Linus, all these guys who are kind of even my age-ish, you know, just seem so much more experienced. You know, I still feel like I just feel like, man, they've been doing it for, I don't know, man, I've been an operator for a long time. I've been in this business since I was, you know, 20 years old. But I don't know, somehow they speak so eloquent. They just seem to know so much. I don't know. I feel like I'm still somewhat experimenting even. I don't know.
It is kind of intimidating when, I know what you mean. Cause then you, you listen. I mean, the John Schwartzman episode was awesome. That guy's a legend.
Yeah.
And you listen to you and you're like, wow, this guy knows everything about everything. And it's intimidating. But I mean,
it,
everyone just has a different style. Like, I think, you know, the stuff that you're doing is current. It's different. And, you know, it's certainly being, do you think anybody can go out there and do a one-to-one aspect ratio now? No. You're going to be like that. It's done. You did it. It's yours. It's over. I mean, it's like that, to claim something like that so young or so early in, I guess, your high-level filmmaking career, that's really something. That's really, really special.
I'm proud of it. And I am. I don't know. It's, you know, I really feel like I've been very lucky to work with a director who writes and directs everything. So we can make bold choices, you know, in any sort of other, my past experiences on a network TV show, everybody wants to just put the zoom lenses on and get sizes and coverage. And maybe you might do a one-er and it'd be really short, but you know, I feel like they don't really have a lot of, you know, they're not the creators. So I think they're not serving the story. They're trying to, you know, cover their ass, I guess.
Well, what do you think it is? Is it a lack of vision or is it just that they don't have the time? I mean, did you have like a good production schedule for this? Like, did you feel like you had enough time to do what you needed to do?
Yeah, I do. I like this. That was the, you know, this is a fairly expensive show. I mean, certainly.
It's gotta be.
The budget was way higher than Mr. Robot and it was a 30-minute show. We had our schedule was comfortable. I would say comfortable. I mean, there are days, no joke, we would, you know, if we were shooting Heidi and Walter in her office and, you know, it was a lot of page count, you know, but you got in there and you shot that. We weren't moving the camera a lot. It was mainly just, you know, static camera setups.
Yeah.
We would take two penalties and go home. I mean, we literally 7 hours into the day, we would go home. It was awesome.
Wow.
I mean, it didn't happen every day, but, you know, yeah, it was like, but that type of thing, you know, where we may not shoot an entire day, we'll just rehearse the one-er today. And that's what we're going to do. If we get around to shooting it, awesome. If we are still working it out, then, you know, we'll come back in tomorrow and we'll finish working out and shoot it tomorrow. I mean, that's a pretty big luxury for a television show. And you know, that's the only kind of place where that happened here. But yeah, that was like, you know, where, you know, you have time to make everything as perfect as you can make it within reason.
Yeah.
And you know, people, and you're supported by people who care about, you know, telling the story. It's not just about, you know, I mean, you could have done that in 13 different shots and been done with it a lot sooner and probably didn't cost near as much money, but you know, Sam's very, you know, deliberate in his storytelling and that's what he wanted to do. And so, and you, you know, yeah, it was awesome, dude. I have to say it was like the best schedule. It's the best job I've ever had to this point. No joke. It's like, it was nice to be able to have, you know, time and a little bit of money to, make all the, you know, not have to cut the corners like I feel like I have to do a lot of other times.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially for TV. Jesus, you hear so many stories about TV rushing so quickly that and was this a single camera shoot?
Yeah. I mean, I had a B camera, but you know, we would use it in Julia's office, you know, K2, she's a friend of mine, was the B operator and shot all the second unit stuff. You know, we would use it sparingly. I mean, we use it, B camera on Robot a fair amount, but you know, everything's such a deliberate thing. So, you know, never are we ever like, oh, throw the B camera in there, get a piece of coverage. You know, we already know exactly what the shots are. So if B camera can serve us and tick off one of the things on our shot list, great. If it can't, then we'll just do it with one camera.
You are listening to the PremiumBeat.com Song of the Week. It's called Cookin' by Wolves. Premium Beat is the place to go for all of your royalty-free music and sound effects. If you go to Premium Beat, you get access to their collection of thousands of royalty-free tracks for as low as $59 each. But you don't just get the actual individual track, you get so much more. You get loop sets, you get cutdowns, you get stems. But what you really get is customization, because you can use all those pieces to fit into your project perfectly.
course, this song is going to be on the show notes at gocreativeshow.com. But head over to premiumbeat.com and search for yourself. There's so much there. You guys are going to love it. Premiumbeat.com. And lastly, Rule Boston Camera. Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent all of your production equipment. They've got a world-class inventory, a gigantic inventory of rental gear from cameras, and audio, lighting, grip, communications, camera dynamics, all the toys you want. It's a toy store. It's a toy store. Let's be honest. Of course, they have a huge selection of lenses too. But really the most important thing, honestly, is their service. Because production is mission critical. That's the business we're in. You know, every day is very, very expensive, and Rule has got your back. So you're going to get expert advice and counsel in pre-production. So you get technical guidance when you take the equipment out on your shoot, and they are committed to making sure that your shoot goes off without a hitch. That's what they're all about. So they're committed to you the whole time you're on location. So we're talking about peace of mind. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about a partnership. This is not just renting and buying and just here you go, take it, see you later. This is a true partnership with professionals that understand the equipment and understand how important your production is to you, to them, to everybody. They understand it all. And that's why we love those guys. So head over to Rule Boston Camera over at rule.com, R-U-L-E.com. We've got some fan questions. If you want to tackle these, and you may have answered some of these already, who knows? But Jamie Dickinson is asking you, how much do you collaborate with your colorist during pre-production and post-production?
Quite a bit. So you know, especially designing the LUT with what I'm going to shoot. So you know, on this one, it was Photochem, and it was a new camera for me. So that was, you know, it was a little nerve-wracking going into such a big job, having never shot on this camera. So I didn't do that many tests. I wish I could have done more, but you know, our prep was getting a little crazy there towards the end. But I had them build a LUT and I kind of treat LUTs as like film stock. So I don't really do a lot of coloring, you know, once I have the LUT, I just sort of light to that. And that's just going to, you know, I don't really do it, but bring the contrast down or whatever. I don't really ever touch that stuff. So for me, in order to be able to shoot that way, which I think makes a more match, you know, the show matches better in the end when I do go to do the final color, if I'm not constantly tweaking, you know, with the DIT. I worked with the color scientist there, and we had this LUT and I tested it and it was pretty good. And then my DIT, had worked with Steve Yedlin, and, Yedlin made a 5219 LUT that perfectly matches 5219 film stock. And I mean like perfectly,
really?
I mean perfectly. Panda is his name. He asked Steve if that would be okay if we used it. And, we used the 5219 LUT, and, it's a very light hungry LUT. It makes the camera like 320 ISO.
Wow.
But I don't know. I thought it was really beautiful and it worked perfectly for, you know, sunny Florida, you know. Now when I get into Walter Valpato, who's the colorist over at Photochem, he may have moved now to Technicolor maybe, but he was my final colorist, and I sit with him through the whole thing, and you know, I like to think that there's not a whole lot to be done in terms of, you know, it's just minor tweaking, shading a wall where I maybe, you know, couldn't fit a flag in or something like that. I don't spend that much time in the final grade. I mean, it goes by pretty quick in my opinion, having sat in a few others with other DPs. I'd say the most important one for me is the initial, you know, defining what that LUT's going to be or two or three of them. On Robot this season, I have three that I'm flipping between because there's different stories there. But that's the biggest part for me is getting the LUT defined before shooting.
We got two questions for your work on Robot. And I feel bad that we didn't cover it, you know, as well as we did Homecoming, but I'm just not as familiar with the show. You know what I mean? So it's like, what are you going to do? So the listeners who are pissed about that, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, it's a great show. I just haven't leaped into it as well. And I don't know, there it is again. Homecoming is just fresh in my mind. So I couldn't resist, people. I just couldn't resist. I've got the guy on the phone. I got to talk to him about the thing I'm obsessed with.
All of them. I love it.
So Rosemary Clark asking, this is kind of a different question. She's saying, have you seen scene analysis videos that are on Reddit of your work on Mr. Robot?
Yeah, I've seen a few, of course. But it's hard not to.
Specifically, they said, it's one of the scenes between Elliot and his therapist. Wanted to know if you've seen it, if you have any thoughts on it. I don't know if this person is involved but...
I think it's the one we decided to. There was, I think it's season one, and Elliot and his therapist. The dynamics are changing in that scene. So at the beginning, Gloria, his therapist, has control of the conversation, and then as it goes along, Elliot takes control of it. So what we decided to do was on both singles is start. High looking down on Elliot, and as the scene progresses, we just slowly boom down and tilt up until at the very end we're looking up at him like a hero. And then conversely, on her side, we start low, and then by the end of the scene, we're now boomed up and looking down on her. So we have this sense of like you feel the power dynamic change visually in the scene. That was the idea of it. But I've seen it. Yeah, they talk about it. It's funny. It blows me away that people would spend any amount of time talking about the work we do, but cool.
That must be cool though, just to know that people are obsessing over it that much. That's interesting. Does it ever like bring a perspective to you that you weren't even thinking about? Have you ever seen those things and be like, Jesus, I wasn't even intending that, but I guess it's true. I don't know.
You know what? Yes, it is. Like sometimes, like I forget what it was, but like, it was on Reddit where somebody, people were talking about it and I can't remember what it was, but they brought up, they're like, and then, after whatever device we did or whatever we did, I can't remember, but they're like, and then they went on with it. And I was like, oh shit. I was like, yeah, God, that does work. I mean, that wasn't the intention, but that's totally awesome. I mean, I was having this conversation with my gaffer yesterday and I was like, we were shooting a shot and like it all of a sudden it just turned into this amazing looking, image. And I was like, from a light that I'd forgot to turn off even. And I was like, how many DPs do you think just sometimes like get lucky, like something turns out to look so awesome. You're like, oh shit. Like it wasn't intentional. You just kind of, found yourself in this moment. You're like, wow. And he's like, Todd, and this guy, Andy Day, he's been a gaffer. I mean, he's a huge gaffer. And he's like, it happens more often than you think. And I was like, it must, dude. I was like, that's awesome. I love that because it's happened to me. But yeah, that idea. Yeah. Sometimes, people find stuff in there that like, I didn't even think about, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, So yeah, it's interesting other people's take on it. Like I sometimes I'm really fearful of reading Reddit when the episodes, come out that day. Not unlike Fabian Wagner as of late, any light in New York? What's going on? Why is this show so damn dark? So we've definitely been accused of shooting things too dark, which I kind of wear as a badge of honor. But that's why sometimes it's fun to read Reddit, and also sometimes you're like, oh my God, I should do something else with my life. This is not working.
And lastly, we've got Alan Almeida is asking, what was the hardest shot you've done for Mr. Robot? It's a hard question because I'm sure there's a bunch. So maybe it doesn't even have to be the hardest, but one of the hardest shots.
It's like every day.
It just seems like it. Like, who's the one between you and Sam that really pushes it? Are you ever like, does he ever come to you with all these ideas and you're like, oh my God, can we just do a regular shot for just a second? Does that ever happen?
Yeah, all the time. Dude, at the beginning of season three, this will kind of answer that question. It's not a shot, but it's a sequence. It's actually a full episode. When I read season three, when they sent me the scripts, the whole first episode, New York City's in a blackout. And it's exterior nights with cars driving and all this shit. I'm like, dude, like, are you kidding me? Like, you want to black... know what that takes. It's because we can't just VFX out every storefront, every neon sign.
And yeah, it's a
cars
nightmare.
Traveling 8 blocks in the city. So it's like, and that means how do you light that? Where's the light coming? I mean, it's like, how do you like that whole thing was like, oh my God, your first inclination is like, this new, whatever Panasonic camera shoots at 20,000 ISO, but really it's like, It's not about like getting a faster camera in that situation. It's about getting, you know, stopping down to kill any sort of ambient light that may be coming from around the corner. So, you know, you end up shooting at like a 5-6.
Yeah, the more sensitivity would be worse.
Yeah, it's I was like, oh, okay. Well, and then I was like, oh, that's stupid. I was like, so, you know, yeah, especially when I first read it, I was like, Jesus, Sam, like a blackout in the city? Like that is crazy. You know, when we ended up pulling it off, it was a condor every block for like 8 or 10 blocks, you know, with a big soft light up there, and then just turn off all the streetlights and buy out all the businesses on the street and go to work. Yeah, that was the one where it was just like, that felt pretty impossible when we were starting that. And man, yeah, difficult sequence to episode in general. I mean, and then I shot literally by candlelight in some of those apartments, literally just with candles, which was cool and fun.
Oh my God. I love those stories.
Yeah, that was crazy. And so that, there's hard shots every day, but that was like definitely like, God, how are we going to do this?
Now, have you guys finished season 4? Are you still shooting it right now?
We're about halfway through right now. We have another like 40 or 50 days. This one's just long. It's 12 because it's the final season.
Yeah.
There's a few more episodes than normal. But yeah, it's good. You know, it's like the other day, Rami and we were all sitting around and just like, as much as, you know, I was like, God, I can't wait to finish Mr. Robot and start telling other new stories and do all this stuff. Then, you know, the other day I was like, God, we're halfway through the season already. I mean, I'm only going to, you know, to all of it, Rami, the cast, Sam, you know, everybody who's involved with the show, this is about to be over. And it's just been such an awesome process. And obviously 4 years of it, it's like, starting to get a little sad. At the beginning, I was like, I can't wait to get through this and let's go do a movie and get ready for the next thing. And yeah, now it's a little lamenting somewhat.
I can only imagine your budget's gone up. I mean, between Rami's, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody performance and all the accolades that made, it's Mr. Robot's final season. You've been doing it for a while now. I mean, things have got to be a lot different now than they were season 1.
Let me just say this. You would be very surprised, I think.
Really?
I don't think that, I don't know exactly the number. I think it maybe went up like, you know, $200,000 an episode. I really believe that's like accurate.
Wow.
So it's not, you know, and Sam doesn't, you know, as he's evolved as a filmmaker, you know, he doesn't go do anything small. It's like, you know, things are complicated. It's very technical. Everything we do it's a tough season. And, you know, I think this has been let out. I should probably be careful. It all takes place over Christmas.
Wow. Like
3 days or something.
Oh, so you got to play with a lot of lights.
Well, yeah, we got some Christmas lights going this year. It's awesome. yeah. But we don't have like, I was hoping it would be like that, but yeah, we seem to be at the same place we were. And I don't know how these guys are figuring out, you know, I mean, there are days we have 3 techno cranes. If we have 3 locations and you can't to have the time to move a techno crane to the second location, so you just have one waiting for you everywhere you show up. It's insane. Every day. It's nuts.
Wow. Wow. Well, what can we expect? I mean, we're hearing now it's about, it takes place over Christmas. What can we expect in this season? What can you tell us? What can't you, you know, what are you allowed to tell us?
Man, I gotta be careful. I've gotten in trouble in the past for, running my mouth. Christmas, I feel like, is the only thing I say. It's going to be, I can't wait to see what people say when they see the end of the series. It will be talked about for a while, I have a feeling.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty, pretty, pretty crazy.
I've got time to catch up. That's what I'm hearing. This thing is it's a fall release, right?
Yeah, I think I think the final episode airs like right at Christmas or something.
Wow.
Maybe. I think so, yeah. Oh, it's going to be crazy. It is crazy. Hopefully everybody will be able to appreciate all the hard work that's gone into it. I mean, it is just, I am tired.
When do you guys wrap?
First week of August.
Mm-hmm. So you've got quite a while to go.
Yeah, we got a ways, and then I don't know, probably take some time off, and then I think we'll go into a feature with Sam after this wraps up.
That would be great.
It sure would, man. I'm ready to. I've never shot a movie, so for me, you know, television is great, and I've been so lucky to be a part of like really, really, really awesome projects. But you know, I always joke with like other DP friends, you know, who do movies. I'm like, I don't know. I guess I broke a bunch of mirrors when I was a kid. I've just got all this bad luck. I can't get out of television. So I'm happy to hopefully be able to walk away from TV for a minute anyway and do a feature. That would be the goal. It'd be nice to tell, you know, to have 63 days. We had 63 days to shoot Homecoming. And talking to Rami, I think they had 60 days to shoot Bohemian Rhapsody. I'm like,
oh my God.
So you know, we had 300 pages of work to shoot for Homecoming, and you know they had like 115 for the same amount of days. I'm like, that is what I'm talking about. That is where you can spend your time, make everything absolutely perfect, and not have to rush so much. And even Homecoming was generous. It still felt like there were days where you're like, God, I'm going to hurry. You know?
I have no doubt that is in the cards for you. And I'm hoping that there's got to be another season of Homecoming, right? Can't be one and done. Yeah.
There will be. There's another season of Homecoming. I think they're writing now. Sam and I won't go back to Homecoming. I think it's more of to my understanding, it's kind of like anthology based. So it's, you know, be new actors, a different story.
New looks and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, kind of the way, and not sort of the way like way Fargo kind of did, you know, they did,
yep.
They bounced back and forth. What a beautiful show that is.
Oh my God, how great was that?
Season two, I mean, I still say this, you know, is really incredible. I just watched this show. James Whitaker is the DP, Amazon show. Oh God, what's the name of it? I think it is the most underrated show. And I'm saying photographically, it's probably the best thing I've seen on TV. I mean, outside of like Game of Thrones, something that has that kind of money.
But, High Castle? Man in the High Castle?
No, it's a Patriot. Oh, God. Patriot.
Oh.
Amazon Prime original.
I've never even heard of it. I'm looking at it right now.
Dude, I'm telling you right now, watch that show. That DP is unbelievably good. I just think that's the most underrated show. I could not believe it when I saw the visuals in that show. It is exceptional. Really? That guy is really good. Really good.
So yeah, it'll be a whole different cast, whole different crew, whole different look for the next season of Homecoming, which is exciting in and of itself, but you guys won't be involved this time around.
That's correct. Yeah.
Oh, well, I guess we're just going to have to watch it without your influence, but that's okay. I'm sure there's a lot more to come with you guys. Excited about Mr. Robot season 4 and just so happy that you came on the show to talk to us. I mean, your work really is incredible. And I know you haven't been at it for too long, but wow, you have a career ahead of you. That is for sure.
I appreciate you saying so. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. I wanted to do this show a long time ago. I was just like, what am I going to say on that show? I know it's like all these other guys sound so good. I'm like, oh my God, I'll be exposed. I was terrified.
I bet you never thought we'd spend 5 minutes talking about hats.
Yeah, exactly, man. Ben, thank you very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. There he goes, Todd Campbell. He is a phenomenal cinematographer. I mean, if you're not familiar with his work, get familiar with it, people. This stuff is so striking and just, I love it. It just hits me right in my soul. So I'm really excited that he was on the show to talk all about it. Yeah, I get to fanboy out sometimes. So what? That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. You know what else it's all about? Good sound. You know who's going to give you good sound? Matt Russell from Gain Structure. He mixes and masters and makes this show sound so good. He also does it for all the BC Media Productions work that I do. He's mixing it and making it sound really good and delicious. He can do the same thing for your projects. All you got to do is reach out to him at gainstructure.com, gainstructure.com, and on Twitter at gainstructure. Of course, while you're on Twitter, you can tweet us at Go Creative Show. Give us some guest suggestions. Don't forget to visit our Instagram and follow us there. And of course, our sponsors, Hedge.video, Rule Boston Camera, Magnanimous Rentals, Shutterstock, and Premium Beat. Support those that support us. See you next time.